welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us on axissacramento.org, or we're at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, and you can friend us on Facebook. Today's program is not a political topic. It's NPR's national correspondent Eric Weiner joins guest host Ted Astrogatti for a discussion of his new book, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World.
Okay, we'll go to your calls now. It is Peter in Berkeley. Actually, we're going to Nicholas in Oakland. Good morning, Nicholas. You're on Forum on KQED with Eric Weiner.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask about what you said about Switzerland, that they were the happiest, but they had the highest suicide rate, or they have legalized suicide and they have a lot of suicide. But I was thinking, does that skew the result? Because before the psychologist comes along to poll the person, they've knocked themselves off. All the people would have scored ones and twos. In the average, would have distorting the average.
You're right. In fact, I was going to raise that point, but thought it might be in bad taste. But I'm glad you did it for me. And you're essentially right. That's one reason.
Do they have a higher suicide rate because they have a legalized, or is it doesn't make much of a difference, or what?
I think as countries where suicide doesn't have the prohibition, religious prohibitions, et cetera, they do have higher suicide rates. And well, look, one Swiss person said, look, you know, if you're in Switzerland and you're not happy, you think, oh, what's wrong with me? Everyone's so darn happy. Why aren't I happy? And
right. If
you're in Moldova and you're not happy, you're just like, hey, I'm one of the people, you know? So that's another reason. But the main reason is that the things that prevent us from, let me put it this way, the things that prevent us from killing ourselves are not the same things that make us happy. In other words, they're two different things. There might be a religious prohibition on suicide, but that's not the same as having high levels of trust in good government, the kind of things that make us happy. And also, let's face it, thank goodness the suicide rates, even in these countries with high suicide rates, are still fairly low. So if a psychologist is doing a survey of 1,000 people, the chances of coming across someone who's suicidal are still quite low. But basically, Nicholas is right.
And Nicholas, thank you very much for the call. We go now to Peter from Berkeley. Peter, you're on Forum on KQED.
Hi, thanks for this interesting subject. I wanted to pick back up on the discussion about trust or its lack. And, of course, one of the things that would encourage trust in any society would be the ethical commitments and behaviors of its citizens. So it seems to me that it stands to reason that a more ethical society, a society dedicated to ethics for all, and not just holding politicians or, you know...
When you're talking about ethical behavior, you're certainly talking about standards of good and bad, right?
Yeah, don't lie, don't cheat,
the golden
act
rule.
With integrity as much as possible. Do your best, you know, to be a good person towards others as well as yourself. It seems to me that this would definitely equate with higher levels of happiness on average. And there is a website promoting a set of ethics for all, so-called universal peace ethics or highest common ideals, and that's at staralliance.org.
All right, thank you very much.
Where everyone can be a star.
There you go.
It's an interesting point, but it basically there's a problem of what the social scientists call causality, mm-hmm, or reverse causality, and what we call the chicken and egg problem. What came first, you know, the ethical behavior or the trust, you know, for instance, when it comes to democracies, we tend to think that democracies make people happy. I mean, this is part of U.S. foreign policy. We want to spread democracy around the world, thinking that democracies will be happier. Well, in fact, there's considerable evidence that it works the other way, that it's happy societies where there's a lot of trust, mm-hmm, for instance, that tend to form democracies. So what comes first? I mean, in order to have this set of, you know, ethical guidelines that Peter was talking about, it seems to me that you need to have trust first. Or, I don't know, maybe you have the ethical guidelines first, the rules of behavior in society, and then trust flows from that. But someone has to be the first person to say, I'm going to trust you enough to form a democracy or to live by these code of ethics. And it's a chicken and egg problem, and it's a difficult one to unravel.
Okay, Margaret sends in an email about xenophobia. Xenophobia is rampant in Switzerland right now. Xenophobia is, of course, related to nationalism. It's also hate-mongering, which is not the hallmark of a happy people. Your project is worthy, and I'd love to hear you talk, but could we please complicate this definition a little bit more? Want to
yes,
muddy the waters a bit?
Let's complicate. I'm all for complicating okay. things as much as possible. Not a recipe for happiness, complicating things. But Margaret raises an interesting point. First of all, I want to say this, that some people may look at the book and say, okay, you went to these countries like Switzerland and Thailand and India and places that are not perfect by any means. And I don't mean to be endorsing Switzerland as this nirvana or this utopia.
No, because in some ways you say in the book that happiness is, when you go there to, for example, Switzerland, it's a unique form of Swiss happiness, if you will, that it may not correspond to your particular notion of happiness,
right.
or it may your ideal of happiness.
Right, it may not fit me. A couple of points. One is, and the science of happiness, especially when it comes to geography, has reached some politically incorrect conclusions, and they may make us a bit uncomfortable, but here they are. One is that most of the happiest countries in the world tend to be homogenous. Switzerland is it does have a fair number of foreigners, but it's linguistically diverse, but in many ways, religiously and otherwise, homogenous. And Iceland is certainly homogenous. Denmark, another very happy place. You know, in America, we celebrate diversity, and I think for good reason. But statistically, the happiest places in the world are homogenous. And when it comes to the, I think it was Margaret, her point about trusting others and trusting your neighbors, there's a question that they put to people around the world. And that question is, overall, most people can be trusted. Do you agree with that? Yes or no? Simple statement. You either agree, yes or no. And the countries where most people say yes, most people can be trusted, tend to be the happiest. And by the way, this is an unhappy fact, is when Americans are presented with that question when we were presented with it in the 1960s, a majority of people said yes, most people can be trusted. When the survey was repeated in the 1990s, only 35% of Americans agreed with that statement. Yes, most people can be trusted. So that may not bode very well for American happiness.
If you'd like...
There's a big brown cloud in the city, and the countryside to sin. The price of life is too high to give up, it's gotta come down again. But worldwide war is over and done, and the dream of peace comes true. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up, and eating that rainbow stew. When we find out how to burn water, and the gasoline car is gone. When an airplane flies without any fuel and the sunlight heats our home. But one of these days when the air clears up and the sun comes shining through, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. All right, Marky. You don't have to get high to get happy. Just think about what's in store. When people start doing what they ought to be doing, then they won't be booing no more. When a president goes through the White House door, does what he says he'll do, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew.
Going to France now, talking to Tom. Good morning, Tom. Welcome to Forum.
Yes, good morning. Wonderful program and subject. I'd like to make a comment about what I would like to call the sense of entitlement that perhaps we have about happiness today, and perhaps the element of being a fashion. I'm reminded of a passage of a book that one of my former teachers, Lewis Mumford, used to quote to who would read the Brothers Karamazov every year. And in that book, there's a passage of the character Alyosha, who, as you may remember, was constantly looking for happiness. When he finally met the priest that was to put him on his path, he was told to his frustration, you will never be happy, but you will always love life. That reminds me that even, you know, the time Dostoevsky was writing this book, this this notion of entitlement to happiness and the fashion of happiness was already an issue, at the expense of perhaps loving life. I'd like to hear your...
All right. Thank you, Tom.
I mean,
the fact that he was taught by Louis Mumford is pretty impressive.
That's amazing. And he raises an interesting point, which is, I think, the paradox of the search for happiness. I think it was Eric Hoffer who said, the search for happiness is one of the chief sources of unhappiness. And it's true. Again, it comes back to American ambition, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a very active verb, pursuit and pursuing. And so we want to achieve happiness the way we want to achieve career success, et cetera. But, I mean, happiness is and definitely this is a conclusion I've reached from thinking about this for quite a while now, it is a byproduct of a life lived well. It is what happens when you're not looking. Who was it? John Stuart Mill said that happiness it should be approached sideways like a crab. And I love that image of
the
crab walking sideways.
And crawling.
What he means is you have to sort of sneak up on it. You can't tackle it head on. It is... again, it is a byproduct or a side effect or however you want to put it. But, you know, if you've ever been in a happy moment or you've been perhaps engaged in a sport or listening to a piece of music and you stop and you think to yourself, wow, I really am happy now, I guarantee that you will no longer be happy. The awareness of being happy is counter to being happy. And it's one of the great paradoxes. And that's why I think the countries that I visited around the world that tend to be the happiest tend actually to not be so so obsessed, really, with the pursuit of happiness. I mean, in this country, I don't think there's any other country in the world besides the U.S. that thinks about, cogitates on, meditates on, talks about their happiness all the time.
Just enter any bookstore and go to the self-help section, right?
Right. And this is, you know, some people have called my book a self-help book, but I take umbrage.
Good. No, I don't
good.
See that.
Because I talk about the self-help industrial complex, as I call it in my book. I think it can be counterproductive because the message from all these self-help books is essentially that happiness lies inside of you, inside of yourself. You need to get in touch with your inner child, your inner talk show host, whatever, inner you're in touch, getting in touch with, and always look inward. On one hand, I understand that it makes sense that we need to be grounded and not swayed by outside circumstances, but it can become extremely narcissistic. I mean, we know that most of our happiness is derived from our relationships with other people, from the outside world, really, the quality of our government, the trust that we have. And I do think that place matters, and that's one theme in my book that I constantly harp on, which is place matters. Even in this day and age of wireless connections and cell phones, where we live affects who we are.
Okay, we'll go to some emails here. Actually, I'm going to sort of shotgun these emails from Brian, Mark, and Tammy, who all wrote in a variation of a question. Brian writes, are the happier people in societies where government provides many of the basics, including health care for all and services for the elderly, do you think the ultimate goal is to be happy, or is that something else? That's from Mark in San Francisco. And Tammy, writing in from Oregon, says, can you comment on any correlation between what the media reports and the happiness index of the country? So we have actually just three different perspectives here, you know, about health care and basic needs and ultimate goals in life, and also the media.
Okay. Sort of, well, let me tackle the first one about essentially the welfare state. I think that seems to be the question of whether people living in a welfare state or a country where people's needs are taken care of by the government, are they happier than others? Not necessarily. Again, I put this in one of the politically incorrect conclusions of the science of happiness. Yes, people need to be healthy and they need to have their health. It turns out that it's our perception of our health that determines our happiness even more than our actual health. In other words, you know, you might feel very healthy and not be quite so healthy, but it's how you feel about your health that matters.
Right.
And I think, you know, people need to have their needs met one way or another. It could be through tribal connections. It could be through the government. It need not be through the government.
And then what about the media connection about...
I mean, that's an interesting one. You know, it sort of goes right to the heart of my book, which is, you know, a former foreign correspondent writing about happiness. You know, I think all, you know, it's a tenet of journalism around the world, of, in free states, at least in free countries, that you focus on the negative. And it certainly would create the impression that we live in an unhappy world. There is evidence that, in fact, I think this is pretty much a proven fact, that there are fewer people dying in wars and in armed conflict today than there were in the height of the Cold War in 1980s, say, when there were a lot of proxy wars. And also, one little factoid I took away with from the World Database of Happiness is that most of the world is happy. I mean, just they score above on the 0 to 10 scale, mm-hmm. above a 5, above the median of 5. And I don't think you would necessarily know that reading the newspapers and watching TV and listening to the radio, that most of the world is happy. I mean, I'm a person. I'm not happy. Where are these happy people? And and yet it's true. So I think that the media does distort the nature of the world, but it's the job of the media to do that, and it's the job of quixotic people like myself to write books that go in the other direction.
All right. We go to Judy now in Berkeley. Welcome to Forum, Judy.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the program. I'm enjoying it a lot. And I wondered how Greece came out on your meter, because when I've been in Greece, I find, you know, it's like the Zorba, the Greek myth. I found that the people are knocking back ouzo and laughing and talking. Despite all the problems the country's had, I find that the people have a devil-may-care attitude. And I did notice a lot of laughter when I was there, wherever I went, either on the mainland or on the islands. And I just wondered if you were there and what you found.
No, I did not go to Greece, but I know that it falls in what I call the middle latitudes of happiness, not the mm-hmm. most happy and not the least happy.
I look out and I see a land, young and lovely, hard and strong. For 15,000 years, we've danced your praises, prayed our thanks, and we've just begun. This is my country, young and growing, free and flowing sea to sea. Yes, this is my country. Walks the high country, giving free wild samples and setting an example how to give. Yes, this is my country, retching and turning like a baby learning how to live. Another way to love.
there's another way to love her.
And now for something completely different.